Welcome to Victory Over Communism with Bill Gertz, the only program willing to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. Your host and guide to victory over communism is one of the nation's most experienced national security journalists, Bill Gertz, who uses unique facts, pinpoint analysis, and exclusive interviews to identify and counter today's destructive communist ideologies. Now, Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.
Welcome to the podcast. The VOC podcast covers ideology, Chinese communist ideology, and American Marxism. It's not about people who are free to believe in whatever they choose. My goal is to educate people to the realities of Marxism-Leninism and highlight in a unique way why it is false and destructive. This episode examines Chinese communism under Supreme Leader Xi Jinping. I will be drawing on the work of John Garneau, an Australian journalist who has also worked with the Canberra government in exposing Chinese influence operations down under. Garneau was among the most experienced reporters in China and gave an internal presentation to the government in August of 2017. Despite the intervening years, his analysis of Chinese communism remains spot on. He calls it engineers of the soul. Communist ideology is most tightly bound to the Chinese political system than any place on earth, with the possible exception of North Korea. And in fact, China under Xi Jinping is becoming a communist totalitarian state. For many policymakers in government, communist ideology is anathema when dealing with China. The main reason is the baggage left over from the 1950s and the anti-communism of that period. As a result, there's been a tremendous effort over the past 40 years to normalize China after it emerged from the disasters of the Cultural Revolution and other communist policies, and sought to develop itself from a backward nation. As Garneau puts it, it was a way of avoiding a food fight about who is pro or anti-China. Taking the Communist Party out of China was a way of deactivating the autoimmune response that can otherwise kill productive conversation. For my listeners, this is precisely the reason I launched the VOC podcast. It is absolutely essential that we understand the nature of the communist system in China in order to confront it and ultimately prevent it from taking over the world. One key to understanding that is educating ourselves to the ideology that frames the language, perception, and decision of Chinese leaders. In order to map the CCP genome, we must understand its ideological DNA. What Chinese communists did was not an immaculate conception of ideology. Instead, the communists combined it with an existing ideological system, the classical Chinese dynasty system. Marxism-Leninism was interpreted by Mao and his fellow revolutionaries by a crucial intermediary, Joseph Stalin. Communism, as interpreted by Lenin, Stalin, and Mao, is a total ideology. It is totalitarian. And Xi Jinping has reinvigorated ideology to an extent not seen since the Cultural Revolution, which ran from 1966 to 1976. Garneau explains that from his work as a journalist and writer in The New China, the term used by the party, that the formal ideology of communism coexists with an unofficial ideology of old China. The founding fathers of the PRC came to power on a promise of to repudiate and destroy everything about what they regarded as the dark imperial past. However, they never really changed the mental wallpaper. Mao and his comrades grew up with tales of imperial China. They never stopped reading them. The dream of the Red Mansions, the Three Kingdoms, the Chinese classics are all about the rise and decay of dynasties. This is the meta-narrative of Chinese literature and historiography that still persists today. Mao, in particular, was obsessed, as Mao's one-time secretary Li Ru explained to Garneau, who said he only slept on one-third of the bed and the other two-thirds of his bed were covered in books, all of which were thread-bound Chinese books, Chinese ancient books. His research was the strategy of emperors. That was how to govern the country. That was what he was most interested in. And the founding revolutionaries passed some of these tales down to their children. The daughter of Mao's leading propagandist, Hu Chaimu, said her father raised his voice to her only once when she confessed that she hadn't finished the dream of the Red Mansions, which, by the way, runs to a million characters. Hu Chaimu was furious. He told her Chairman Mao had read the book 25 times. So, this is the observation about ideology. Ideology, in the broadest sense, as a coherent system of ideas and ideals, the founding families of the PRC are steeped in the dynastic system. Now, communism and feudal imperialism are not directly linked, but they are not irreconcilable. The formula for dynastic communism was perfected by Chen Yun. Their children had to inherit power, not because of privilege, but because they could be counted on to be loyal to the revolutionary cause. Or as he put it, at least our children will not dig up our graves. Xi Jinping, since coming to power in 2012, exercised an unwritten aristocratic claim to power, which derives from his father's proximity to the founder of the Red Dynasty, Chairman Mao Zedong. He is the compromise representative of all the great founding families. This is the starting point for understanding the worldview of Xi Jinping and his princeling cohort. Princelings, by the way, are the offspring of communist revolutionaries who rule China today and control its entire system. They don't call themselves princelings. Instead, they regard themselves as revolutionary successors. China remains stuck in the cycle that had created and destroyed every dynasty before it. In this tradition, when you lose political power, you don't just lose your job, as you might in the Western system. You lose your wealth, you lose your freedom, and you probably lose your life and possibly your entire extended family. You are literally erased from history. Winners take all, losers lose everything. As Garneau put it, with these stakes, the English idiom life and death struggle doesn't really cover it. It's too passive. In the Chinese formulation, it is you die, I live. I must kill preemptively in order to live. Xi and his comrades in the Red Dynasty believe they will go the same way as the Manchus and the Mings the moment they forget that. Secondly, and related to the first point, is that China has an extraordinary veneration of the written word. Stories, histories, and teachers have great moral authority, greater than anywhere you can think of, with the exception of maybe Tsarist Russia. This has made both Russia and China culturally receptive to propaganda and the ideology transmitted by propaganda. What is more certain is that China was especially receptive to Soviet ideology because Chinese intellectuals found meaning in Russian literature and texts earlier and more readily than they did with other Western sources. Russian literature was our guide and our friend, said Liu Shun, the Chinese writer and influential figure in early CCP history. In classical Chinese statecraft, there are two tools for gaining and maintaining control over the mountains and the rivers. The first is wu, or weapons and violence, and the second is wen, which is language and culture. Chinese leaders have always believed that power derives from controlling both the physical battlefield and the cultural domain. You can't sustain physical power without elegant power. Wu and wen go hand in hand. The key to understanding the allure of the Soviet Comintern in Shanghai and Guangzhou in the 1920s is that their effective agents told a compelling story. They came with money, guns, and organizational technology, but their greatest selling point was a narrative which promised a linear escape from the dynastic cycle. Actually, according to the Soviet rendering of Marxism, the course of history wasn't exactly linear. Rather, history was said to move along the trajectory of a corkscrew shaped by dialectical rounds of struggle, destruction, and renewal. Mao's discursive advantage was Marxist-Leninist ideology. Language was not just a tool of moral judgment. It was an instrument for shaping acceptable behavior and a weapon for distinguishing enemies and friends. This is the subtext of Mao's most famous poem, Snow. Communist ideology enabled him to weaponize culture in a way his imperial predecessors had never imagined. And it's important to remember who was the leader of the communist world during the entire quarter of a century in which Mao rose to power. It was the great genius, Comrade Stalin. Mao knew Marxist-Leninist dogma was absolutely crucial to his enterprise, but he personally lacked the patience to wade through it. He found a shortcut to ideological proficiency with Joseph Stalin's Short Course on the History of the Bolsheviks, published at the end of Stalin's Great Terror in 1938. According to Li Ryu, when interviewed by historian Li Huayu, Mao thought he'd found an encyclopedia of Marxism and acted as if he'd discovered a treasure. At the time of Stalin's death in March 1953, the Short Course on the History of the Bolsheviks had become the third most printed book in human history. After Stalin's death, when Stalin was eulogized as the great genius on the front page of the People's Daily, the Chinese printers redoubled their efforts. It became the closest thing in China to a religious text. The Short Course is hard reading, but it offers us some of the same shortcut to understanding communist ideology as it did for Mao. Stalin's problem was different to Lenin's. Lenin had to win a revolution, but Stalin sought to sustain it. Stalin's great ideological challenge was to explain that they'd won the revolution, but the long-promised utopia of a perfect equality had to be postponed. He had to rationalize kicking the utopian destination over the horizon and subordinating that ever-receding objective to the imperative of inter-party warfare. Stalin's Short Course is a manual for perpetual struggle against a roll call of imagined dastardly enemies who are collaborating with imagined Western agents to restore bourgeois capitalism and liberalism. It is written as a chronicle of victories by Lenin and then Stalin's correct line over an endless succession of ideological villains. It is perhaps instructive that many of the most vile internal enemies were said to have cloaked their subversive intentions in the guise of reform. The practical utility of the book is that it prescribes an antidote for the calcification and putrefaction that inevitably corrodes and degrades every dictatorship. The most original insight in Stalin's Short Course on the History of the Bolsheviks is that the path to socialist utopia will always be obstructed by enemies who want to restore bourgeois capitalism from inside the party. These internal enemies grow more desperate and more dangerous as they grow increasingly imperiled and as they collaborate with spies and Western agents. The most important lines in the book are, as the revolution deepens, class struggle intensifies. The party becomes strong by purging itself. Well, you can imagine how this formulation was revelatory to a ruthless Chinese leader like Mao, who had mastered the you die, I live world into which he had been born, a world in which you choose to either kill or be killed, and who was obsessed with how to prevent the decay which had destroyed every imperial dynasty before. What Stalin offered Mao was not only a manual for purging his peers, but also an explanation of why it was necessary. Purging his rivals was the only way a vanguard party could purify itself, remain true to its revolutionary nature, and prevent a capitalist restoration. Purging was the mechanism for the Chinese Communist Party to achieve ever greater unity with revolutionary truth as interpreted by Mao. It is the mechanism for preventing the process of corruption and putrefaction which inevitably sets in after the founding leaders of each dynasty leave the scene. Crucially, Mao split with Khrushchev because Khrushchev split with Stalin, and eventually he stood for. The Sino-Soviet split was ideological. It was Mao's claim to ideological leadership over the communist world. Marx, Lenin, Stalin, Mao. It was Mao's claim to being Stalin's true successor. We hear a lot about how she and his peers blamed Gorbachev for the collapse of the Soviet state, but actually their grievances go much further back. They blame Khrushchev. They blame Khrushchev for breaking with Stalin, and they vow that they will never do to Mao what Khrushchev did to Stalin. Now, 60 years on, we're seeing Xi making his claim to be the true revolutionary successor of Mao. Xi's language of party purity, criticism, and self-criticism, the mass line, his obsession with unity, his attacks on elements of hostile Western liberalism, constitutionalism, and other variants of ideological subversion, this is all Marxism-Leninism as interpreted by Stalin and embraced by Mao. This is the language that the deep red princeling spoke when they got together and occasionally when Garneau interviewed them. And this was what Xi spoke about after the Party Congress in 2018. And when he said, to dismiss the history of the Soviet Union and the Soviet Communist Party, to dismiss Lenin and Stalin, and to dismiss everything else is to engage in historical nihilism. And it confuses our thoughts and undermines the party's organization on all levels. Today, the utopian destination has to be maintained, however absurd it seems, in order to justify the brutal means of getting there. Xi has inserted a couple of interim goals for those who lack revolutionary patience, but the underlying Marxist-Leninist, Stalinist-Maoist logic is unchanged. This is the logic of his ever-deepening purge of peers who keep getting in the way, like the purge of the princeling challenger Bo Xilai, Security Chief Zhou Yongkang, two vice chairs of the PLA Central Military Commission, Ling Jihua, Zhen Zhongkai, and recently we've just seen the foreign minister, Hu Jintao, and then the defense minister, all disappeared. Nothing of this is personal. It's dialectical and it's inevitable. It's pushing and accelerating China's journey along inexorable corkscrew-shaped course of history. History needs to be pushed along its dialectical course, Xi said in 2015. History always moves forward and it never waits for those who hesitate. The same logic applies outside the party as within. The essence of Maoism and Stalinism is perpetual struggle. This is the antidote to calcification and putrefaction that has destroyed every previous dynasty, dictatorship, and empire. This is why Xi and his red successor peers believe that Maoism and Stalinism are still highly relevant today. Not just relevant, but existential. Xi has set in motion a purification project, a war against the forces of counter-revolution that has no end point because the notional utopian destination of a perfect communist world will always be kicked a little further down the road. This is what Mao and Stalin understood better than any of their peers. This is what Xi Jinping's deep red restoration is all about. Extreme politics in pursuit of Marxism-Leninism. Engineers of the human soul. Who was the world leader who described artists and authors as the engineers of the human soul? Well, it was Joseph Stalin. The production of souls is more important than the production of tanks, Stalin said, and therefore I raise my glass to you, writers, the engineers of the human soul. To me, this is one of the great totalitarian metaphors, a machine designed to forge completely unity between state, society, and the individual person. The totalitarian machine works to a predetermined path. It denies the existence of free will and rejects abstract values like truth, love, and empathy. Most important from my point of view, this totalitarian view repudiates God, submits to no law, and seeks nothing less than to remold the human soul. The quote from Stalin is from a famous speech at the home of writer Maxim Gorky. It was in preparation for the first Congress of the Union of Soviet Writers in 1932. This marked the end of Stalin's Great Famine and Cultural Revolution, the prototype for Mao's Great Famine and Cultural Revolution in the lead-up to Stalin's Great Terror. For Stalin, Lenin, and the proto-Leninists of the 19th century, Russia, the value of literature and art was purely instrumental. There was no such thing as art for art's sake. In their ideology, poetry has no intrinsic value beyond its purpose of indoctrinating the masses and advancing the cause of communist revolution. Or, to use the engineering language of the original Man of Steel, Joseph Stalin, literature and art are nothing more nor less than cogs in the revolutionary machine. But if you think the answer is Chairman Mao, then you're also right. Mao extended Stalin's metaphor a decade later in his famous Yan'an Forum on Literature and Art, delivered in 1942, and published in heavily doctored form a year later. Our purpose is to ensure that literature and art fit well into the whole revolutionary machine as a component part, that they operate as powerful weapons for uniting and educating people and for attacking and destroying the enemy, and that they help the people fight the enemy with one heart and one mind. This is when Mao made plain that there is no such thing as truth, love, or artistic merit, except insofar as these abstract concepts can be pressed into the practical service of politics. Mao's talk on literature and art was his way of introducing the Yan'an rectification campaign, the first great systematic purge of the Chinese Communist Party. This was a project of orchestrated peer pressure and torture designed first to purge Mao's peers and then to instill communist ideology deep within the minds of hundreds of thousands of idealistic students and intellectuals who had flocked to Yan'an during the anti-Japanese war. Importantly, the Communist Party never sought to persuade so much as to condition by creating a fully enclosed system, controlling all incentives and disincentives and breaking individuals physically, socially, psychologically. The Communists found they could condition the human mind in a way that Pavlov had learned to condition dogs in a Moscow laboratory a few years earlier. This is when Mao's followers first coined the term brainwashing. It's the literal translation of the Maoist term Xinyao, literally washing the brain. Mao himself preferred Stalin's metallurgical metaphor, calling it tempering. If you want to be one of the masses, you must make up your mind to undergo a long and even painful process of tempering, Mao said. And most relevant of all to us today, if you're thinking President Xi was also one of those in this camp, then you're also right. President Xi, or Chairman Xi, to use a more direct translation, was speaking at the Beijing Forum of Literature and Art in 2014. She was arguing for a return to the Stalinist-Maoist principle that art and literature should only exist to serve politics. Not politics as we know it, the straightforward exercise of organizational and decision-making power. Art and literature is the engineering that molds the human soul. Art and literary workers are the engineers of the human soul, she said. Like Stalin and Mao, Xi's speech marked a Communist Party rectification campaign, which included an all-out effort to elevate the respective leaders to cult status. Nothing in Communist Party choreography happens by accident. It should be noted here that when Mao was rallying the country in 1942, he did so under the banner of patriotism, because the idea of communism had absolutely no pulling power. It's no different today. As Xi said, among the core values of socialism with Chinese characteristics, the deepest, most basic, and most enduring is patriotism. Our modern art and literature needs to take patriotism as its muse, guiding the people to establish and adhere to correct views of history, the nation, the country, and culture. And the old warnings against subversive Western capitalism haven't changed either. For Lenin, Stalin, Mao, and now Xi, words are not vehicles of reason and persuasion, they are bullets. Words are weapons for defining and isolating and destroying opponents, and the task of destroying enemies can never end. Thus we see the CCP's united front strategy of influence operation. For Xi, as with Stalin and Mao, there's no end point in the perpetual quest for unity and regime preservation. This is not to say that China could not have turned out differently. Elite politics from Mao's death to the Tiananmen massacres was a genuine contest of ideas, but ideology won that contest. Today, the CCP is the only ruling Communist Party that has never split with Stalin, with the partial exception of North Korea. Stalin's portrait stood alongside Marx, Engels, and Lenin in Tiananmen Square, 18 feet tall, right up to the early 1980s, at which point the portraits were moved indoors. I saw this myself in 1998 when I visited the PLA Museum where they had statues of Stalin. For a long time, we all took comfort in thinking that this ideological aspiration existed only on paper, an object of lip service, while China's 1.4 billion people got on with the job of building families and communities and seeking knowledge and prosperity. But it has been much more than lip service. Since 1989, the party has been rebuilding itself around the draft national security law that calls for ideological security, including defending itself against negative cultural infiltration. AI companies in China, as I wrote in the Washington Times, also have to incorporate communist ideology within their generative values. Propaganda and security, Wen and Wu, the book and the sword, the pen and the gun, and now the electron and the assault rifle are once again inseparable. Party leaders must dare to show their swords to ensure that politicians run newspapers, said Xi in his first National Propaganda Work Conference back in 2013. Xi has now pushed ideology to the forefront because it provides a framework for purifying and regaining control over the vanguard party and thereby the country. In Xi's view, shared by many of his Red Princeling cohort, the cost of straying too far from the Maoist and Stalinist path is dynasty decay and eventual collapse. Everything Xi Jinping says as a leader and everything pieced together from his background reveals he is deadly serious about totalizing this project. In April 2013, the General Office of the Central Committee, run by Xi's princeling right-hand man, Li Jianshu, sent this now infamous political instruction down to all high-level party organizations. It's called Document Number 9, Communique on the Current State of the Ideological Sphere. It set disseminating thought on the cultural front as the most important political task. It required cadres to arouse mass fervor and wage intense struggle against the following so-called false trends. They were Western constitutional democracy, viewed as an attempt to undermine the current leadership, universal values of human rights, which were viewed as an attempt to weaken the theoretical foundations of party leadership, civil society itself, which was deemed a political tool of the Western anti-China forces to dismantle the ruling party's social foundation, and neoliberalism, which it described as U.S.-led efforts to change China's basic economic system. The West's idea of journalism, attacking the Marxist view of news, attempting to gouge an opening through which to infiltrate our ideology, was also denounced, as was historical nihilism, trying to undermine party history, denying the inevitability of Chinese socialism. Also, questioning reform and opening, no more arguing about whether reform needs to go further. There is no ambiguity in the document. The Western conspiracy to infiltrate, subvert, and overthrow the People's Party is not contingent on what any particular Western country thinks or does. It's an equation, a mathematical identity. The CCP exists, and therefore it is under attack. No amount of accommodation and reassurance can ever be enough. It can only ever be a tactic, a ruse. Without the conspiracy of Western capitalism, the CCP loses its reason for existence. There would be no need to maintain a vanguard party. Xi might as well let his party peacefully evolve. This is absolutely essential for everyone in the world to understand. In conclusion, the key point about CCP ideology, the unbroken thread that runs from Lenin through Stalin, Mao, and Xi, is that the party is and always has defined itself as being in perpetual struggle with the hostile forces of world capitalism led by the United States. Xi is talking seriously, and acting decisively to progress a project of total ideological control wherever it is possible for him to do so. Xi didn't invent this ideological project, but he has hugely reinvigorated it. For the first time since Mao, we have a leader who talks and acts like he really means it. And he is pushing communist ideology at a time when the idea of communism is as unattractive as it has ever been in any time in the past 100 years. All that remains is the ideology of power dressed up as patriotism, but that doesn't mean it can't work. Xi has shown that the subversive promise and power of the internet can be inverted. Within a few years of coming to power, she leveraged big data science and artificial intelligence to bend the internet from an instrument of democratization into a tool of total control. The journey to utopia is still in progress, but first we must pass through the cyber-enabled dystopia in order to defeat the forces of counter-revolution. That's how they argue. The audacity of this project is breathtaking, and so too are the implications. The existential danger facing the United States and the non-communist world is that we now see the total ideological control will not stop at China's borders. It is packaged in to travel with the Belt and Road Initiative, the Global Security Initiative, the Maritime and Digital Silk Roads, and many other programs now being used to promote Chinese communism. A global network of Chinese propaganda also is facilitating the spread. This is why if you're involved in the business of intelligence, defense, national security, or international relations, or trade, economic policy, or market regulation, or the arts, higher education, or preserving the integrity of our democratic system, in other words, just about every substantial policy question whatsoever, it's absolutely imperative we learn about this ideological assault by Marxism-Leninism, Mao Zedong thought, and now Xi Jinping thought. I'll be right back after a short break.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
Hi, this is Bill Gertz. I wanted to talk to you briefly about my latest book. It's called Deceiving the Sky, Inside Communist China's Drive for Global Supremacy. This is the most important book you can read to fully understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist government. I urge you to get a copy today. It can be found at my website, The Gertz File, that's GertzFile.com, or at the book site called DeceivingTheSky.com.
If you enjoy listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, please consider helping Bill with his important work of educating patriots just like you about how communism is very real and even more dangerous than ever before. Your donation to the Victory Over Communism program will help expand its reach across America and throughout the world. In fact, you'll be helping to provide the kind of information that may well make its way behind the new Iron Curtain and the Great Firewall of China and inspire those living under communism to seek freedom. Supporting the Victory Over Communism program is easy. Just visit the program website, victoryovercommunism.net, and click on the link at the bottom to GoFundMe.com. Again, just visit victoryovercommunism.net and click on the link to GoFundMe.com. Thanks for listening, and God bless America.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. This is the counter-proposal section of the podcast, what I call the spiritual section. It's based on the teachings of the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon, who has brought a new view of God, humankind, and the universe that is unique and powerful. The VOC worldview that I'm presenting in these sections will truly expose the fundamental fallacies of Marxism-Leninism. But more important, this worldview offers true hope of actually solving the problems of the world that communism is claiming to solve, but will never be able to do so. There's no question communism has a romantic appeal that has misled tens, if not hundreds of millions of people since its founding and imposition. Communism is actually a deviant form of humanism. Basing itself on scientism, communism has demonstrated a unique and tragic ability to win over the young and the idealistic. It promises a world of equality, freedom, and harmony. Its slogans and its visions have been able to attract millions. Communists romanticized their revolution. In his text, From Good Savage to Good Revolutionary, Venezuelan writer Carlos Rangel analyzed the mentality of the Latin American revolutionary and sees him as one in search of an identity as a noble savage, lost due to colonialism. Rangel maintains that some believe that through revolution, the novel savage will be restored and indigenous cultures will return to what Rangel views as the mythical state of innocence. Communism, however, has not liberated any nation. It has, however, caused tremendous suffering and destruction. We need to understand a key truth. Communism and Christianity are not compatible. Yet, instead of opposing communism, some Christians often try to compromise with it. In Latin America, liberation theology provided Christians with a Marxist analysis of history and has led thousands to communism. It is generally acknowledged that without a support base among Christians, the Sandinista revolution in Nicaragua would not have succeeded. For many Nicaraguan Christians, the source of that support was liberation theology. Communism is returning to Nicaragua under Daniel Ortega today. There are various forms of this liberation theology, but the most militant ones view violent confrontation with the system as part of a Christian mandate. This analysis is so powerful that it has led priests such as Colombia's Camilo Torres to dedicate their lives to revolution. For Torres, the true Christian is he who, as did Torres, goes to the mountains with a rifle to participate in communist revolution. In Latin America, communists never approached the Christians in an aggressive manner. They try to win their trust by telling them, "Of course we have nothing against keeping your faith in God. All that we ask is that you accept our view of history." Once they've convinced a person to accept historical materialism, they can proceed to the next step, which is teaching of dialectical materialism, the key tenet of Marxism. This ultimately leads to the denial of God's existence. As I've mentioned in earlier podcasts, dialectical materialism is false. It's based on the idea that constant struggle is the only way to progress, when in fact it is really cooperation which is the key to progress. From a logical viewpoint, however, Christianity and Marxism are not at all compatible. Liberation theology accepts the Marxist interpretation of history. However, Marx's interpretation of history is nothing other than historical materialism, which denies the existence of God. For this reason, the two are incompatible. It's God or no God. It is here that Christians are called to take a stand. In the United States, an intermediary stage prior to communism appears to be based on secular humanism. Secular humanism is outlined in the Humanist Manifesto published in 1933, 85 years after the Communist Manifesto. It expresses, in the humanitarian style of agnostic and atheistic ministers and professors who formed it, essential points of materialism, including belief in a universe that is self-existing and not created, and a human being who is a product of his interaction with nature. Secular humanism glorifies all that is charitable and good in human life. It states that all problems are to be solved by humans alone, and although it does not deny the possibilities of realities as yet undiscovered, believes that only that which can be proven by scientific method exists as reality. The 14th article of the manifesto reads, "The humanists are firmly convinced that existing acquisitive and profit-motivated society has shown itself to be inadequate and that a radical change in methods, controls, and motives must be instituted. A socialized and cooperative economic order must be established." Secular humanism denies the reality of spiritual experience. It limits truth to what can be proven either rationally or empirically. This position will be exploited by Marxism, and at least it has served to dull the spirituality of 21st century people. Also, there is communist persecution of Christians. In China, during the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 76, Christians that had been accommodated by the communist regime were arrested, imprisoned, tortured, and killed under Red Guard zealots. Bibles were destroyed. Churches also were destroyed and looted. In 1992, the crackdown continued, with many Christians imprisoned. House churches are bulldozed, often right around Christmas time. That's a continuing process in China, and it's increasing under Xi Jinping. The CCP has also forced the Catholic Church to submit to CCP rule. A 2018 agreement between the Vatican and Beijing set rules on appointing bishops, and China violated that agreement in 2022 by appointing a CCP official as a bishop, all in an effort to gain access to internal Chinese Catholic decision-making and to influence it. It is imperative that Christians around the world understand the circumstances that Christians in China confront today. Failure to understand what those circumstances are has led many Christians to abstain from supporting their fellow Christians in China. And even worse, it has led sometimes to their supporting those who are persecuting them. The physical effects of communism have been the same everywhere: violence, hunger, elitism, and death. The West, however, has failed to stop the growth of communism. We have lost our idealism and our vision, and for that reason, we have failed to offer a viable response to Marxism. There is a lack of Western awareness of the communist threat. Although Lenin declared from the outset that the communist revolution would not end until the world was communized, we in the West have been unable to grasp the extreme seriousness of Chinese communist threats. In Western cities, thousands participate in protests against cruelty to laboratory animals, but there are no mass protests of communist cruelty to fellow human beings. At the same time, citizens of the West show great concern regarding the buildup of Western armaments, but fail to show similar concern regarding the massive Chinese buildup. That buildup has one goal: to diminish and ultimately defeat the United States and make China emerge as the world's sole superpower, which can then impose its version of Chinese communism on the entire world. To conclude, the development of the religious and humanistic tradition over the past six centuries, the Reformation, the Catholic Counter-Reformation, culminated in the 16th century. This was followed two centuries later by the Great Awakening in America and the Pietist movement in Europe. These religious renewals served as the basis for the American Revolution, as well as the basis for Western democracy. Although in the West we still pay lip service to religious ideals, our societies are becoming increasingly materialistic. Today, all humankind is in need of a worldview that has the ability to revive idealism and altruism in the free world, which can provide real solutions for social and personal problems, and which can promote cooperation and peace among many developed and underdeveloped nations. On the humanistic side, the Renaissance was followed two centuries later by the Enlightenment. This humanistic view contributed not only to the French Revolution, but it also established the philosophical foundation for the communist revolution. French philosopher Maurice Clavel observed that through the Renaissance, man denied sin, through the Enlightenment, he denied revelation, and through communism, he denied God. After a toll of millions of lives, communism has provided no utopian society, nor is it approaching that goal. When you look at this, you have to conclude that neither communism, because of its atheist foundation, nor contemporary Western society, because of its present confusion of values, have effectively responded to human problems. For that reason, we need a new response, one which can unite these two developments. That's where the VOC worldview comes into play. In the past, scientific theory often contradicted religious thought. Society and even some scientists were asked to choose between their traditional religious beliefs and recent scientific findings. Since the Enlightenment, people have often opted for the science. This has changed in the present century. Materialism denied the existence of a spiritual element at work in the physical world, and it sought to rationalize all phenomena on the basis of scientific observation. In The New Class Divided, Alfred Perry points out that today more and more scientists find a contradiction between recent scientific discoveries and communist materialism. Among most scientists, communist theory is perceived as unscientific and outmoded. In light of continued scientific discovery in fields such as nuclear physics, cybernetics, the days of communist absolutism seem to be numbered. Regardless of the process by which humans develop, materialism cannot deny the unique role of the human being in the overall universal order. Only the human being can relate to and appreciate every dimension of the creation: the sea, the stars, plants, fish, reptiles, or mammals. Today, scientists argue that there is increasing evidence that the world was made for man. God chose humanity as an instrument to express his love to the whole creation. For that reason, we can appreciate the whole of nature. The true value of every human being is infinite. Every man is a child of God. Every woman is a daughter of God. The implications of the Judeo-Christian tradition are boundless. Every man and every woman has unique and divine value. Every man and every woman, for that reason, merits our respect, our love, our care, and our concern. People are often blind to others because of selfishness. As we have seen in the 19th century, selfishness was philosophically justified by materialist worldviews. Yet the reality of the latter part of the 20th century and our current century challenges the materialist perceptions. Ultimately, each of us has to reflect about our own selves. Who is my life for? Myself? My family? The nation? The world? God? The great people of history were those who were able to live for the sake of their nation and beyond. Such a lifestyle requires one to go beyond selfishness. We cannot go beyond selfishness without God and an appreciation of the value of each person as a child of God. We need to know that humankind was meant to be one family under God. Because we are one family under God, we can go beyond race and creed and realize a unique family of humankind. Harmony between the religious tradition and humanism and among cultures and natures is the goal of the VOC worldview and the task of all modern humankind. The late U.S. President John F. Kennedy spoke eloquently to the hearts and imaginations of many people when he said, "To those people in huts and villages across the globe struggling to break the bonds of misery, we pledge our best efforts to help them help themselves for whatever period is required. Not because the communists may be doing it, not because we seek their vote, but because it is right." I'll be right back.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters.
Welcome back. This is the news portion of the podcast. For this episode, I'm going to discuss some important congressional action targeting communism. Earlier this month, Representative Maria Elvira Salazar and 27 other House Republicans introduced legislation called the Crucial Communism Teaching Act. Communism is one of the most destructive political ideologies the world has ever seen, Salazar said in introducing the bill. "The Crucial Communism Teaching Act is important because our youth must remember the crimes of the communists, including those inflicted upon my constituents and their families in Florida's 27th district." Salazar is a Cuban-American and comes from a community in Florida that knows the destructive nature of communism from the Cuban variant, a variant that is continuing to inflict destruction on the Cuban people. The legislation would provide educational materials through the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation to educate middle and high school students about the dangers of communism and totalitarianism, and how they are contrary to the founding principles of freedom and democracy in the United States. Over 100 million people have died due to the tragic legacy of communism. However, due to a lack of accurate education materials, almost a third of Generation Z members now say they have a favorable view of communism. The new legislation was inspired by the Never Again Education Act that Congress passed in 2020. That bill set up a program to educate American students about the Holocaust during Nazi Germany through the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. The new bill also continues similar efforts by Florida and other states to mandate that American students be educated on the failed imposition of communism throughout history. American students deserve to know the truth. Communism is not a promise for a more equitable future. It is a brutal ideology that runs counter to democracy and the very principles of our nation that it was founded upon. That's Ken Pope, CEO of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. Sadly, our youth are increasingly unaware of communism's dark legacy, of these 100 million killed and over 1.5 billion still held captive today. The crucial Communism Teaching Act will help to right this wrong as it works to sweep the evil ideology into the ash heap of history. Together, we can remember the victims and stand on the right side of history. The bill will empower the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation to develop a civic education curriculum and oral history with resources from high school students to learn about the malignant, dangerous ideologies that really contradict the foundational principles of American democracy. In a world where freedom, democracy, human rights, and individual liberty are under assault, it's essential that our youth understand the historical context and deadly consequences of communism, which has led to the death of more than 100 million people. It is critical for students to be taught the history of the horrifying death and destruction caused by communism and the present dangers of the ideology. The large number of people who say they are not opposed to communism highlights the failure of the education system to provide that needed historical information. It is the result of leftist infiltration of the education system that is now dominated by liberals and others who regard anti-communism as a greater danger than communism. And this is not an exaggeration. Our current era is a time when our nation is simultaneously seeing an exponential increase in political refugees who are fleeing the horrors of communism and a disconnected educational elite who are promoting the false utopia of a provably flawed idea. The sponsors of the bill say it's imperative that the nation teach the next generation the facts about communism and the depth and breadth of the destruction it has caused for decades. The ideology is in stark contrast to the founding principles of freedom and democracy. America must remain the hope for those around the world seeking freedom and liberty. It was Ronald Reagan who said, as I wrote in the statement in the beginning of my book, Deceiving the Sky, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way we can inherit the freedom we have known is we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with well-fought lessons about how they in their lifetime have to do the same. And you and I don't do this, then you, and if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it was once like in an America where men were free. I'll be right back with the interview portion of the program.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Stand by for more after these important messages.
I spoke to you earlier about my book, Deceiving the Sky. I also wanted to urge you to take a look at another book that I wrote called iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. We live in an information age, and yet we're getting bombarded with enemy propaganda coming at us from all different directions. iWar really helps expose what we need to do and how we need to counter it. I urge you to get a copy. The book can be found at iwarbook.com or at my website, gertzfile.com.
You're listening to Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz, featuring exclusive interviews with today's top newsmakers and trendsetters. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. I'm joined on the program now by Xi Van Fleet, a remarkable woman who knows Chinese communism firsthand. Xi grew up in Mao's China and lived through the turmoil of the Cultural Revolution. Xi underwent forced re-education work in rural fields for 3 years. After Mao died in 1976, Xi was able to go to university and came to America in 1986 to pursue graduate studies. Xi holds master's degrees in English and library science, and for the past 30 years worked in the field of information management. I first came across Xi on Twitter, now X, and was so impressed with her remarkable courage seen in posts exposing Marxism and Chinese communism. She is committed to educating the American people about the horror of socialism and communism and wants to warn them of the danger of Marxist woke revolution that is threatening the country. She also has a book coming out soon called Mao's America, A Survivor's Warning. Xi, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Let me say first that people like yourself are a tremendous resource in helping Americans and people around the world to better understand the nature of communism. Thanks for doing what you're doing. What prompted you to begin speaking out several years ago on this issue?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. To me, it's a process. Actually, after I came here in 1986, I really had paid no attention to politics. And to me, and I think I'm typical of many immigrants, and I just feel like, you know, I escaped communism. Now I'm in America, the land of freedom. What can go wrong? I don't have to pay attention. You know, we have the best government and we have the best the form of government, and everything, you know, will be just fine. I just only need to work on my own stuff, like achieve American dream. And that is a problem, I think. And I paid no attention to politics for a long time until I would say probably 10, 15 years ago, I started to really notice some troubling signs, and started with political correctness. I said, well, this is kind of like the Cultural Revolution that I experienced. But I did not really give it too much thought, and I just did not lose sleep over it. Until it's getting really worse and worse. I noticed that in 2016, and my turning point is 2020. When I saw the chaos, the riots, and on the streets, the burnings, and to me, that is absolutely the Cultural Revolution that I witnessed when I was in China and during the Mao's Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. And that's the turning point. That's when I decided I got to do something. I got to tell Americans that this is not something new. This happened before. It happened to me. And this is going to lead us to destruction of this country. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's when I decided I'll do something. And I joined the local conservative group. And that's how I went to the Loudoun School Board meeting.
And Loudoun County, Virginia. Yeah.
Yes. And the rest is history. Mm-hmm. I did not really expect. I just say, you know, that's my duty to go to my local school and a voice. And my concern and warning people, the CRT is not about anti-racism. It is absolutely Marxism. Mm-hmm. And did not know that will somehow got immediate attention, and 2 years later, here I am, just finished the book, and today I received a copy from the publisher, so I can't believe it. It's real now.
That's great.
This book. Yeah.
Yeah, looking forward to reading it. Earlier in the podcast, I spoke about how Xi Jinping in China is following the Marxist-Leninist playbook first introduced by Stalin, then embraced by Mao and led to the Cultural Revolution. From an ideological standpoint, what do you see going on in China today under Xi? He's kind of reviving Marxism-Leninism.
Absolutely. And I just talked to someone last night, and she was arrested because she was interviewing people in Wuhan during the lockdown. And so we're talking about, what's going on in China. It's absolutely a revival of the Mao's Cultural Revolution. And so one of the things that is very, very telling is that Xi Jinping said he is going to restore the original intention of the CCP. To him, that intent, the original intention was forgotten, and because people was too busy making money, and then they forgot about the original intention, which is bringing about the communism, socialism, communism to China, So he wants to really re-emphasize the importance of Marxism, Leninism, and Mao Zedong thought, and his own thought, Xi Jinping thought, as the guiding principles for China.
Yeah, yeah. You know, people in the past used to say communist China was not like the Soviet Union and was not expansionist. But now we're seeing this as false. And China is using programs like the Belt and Road Initiative, the Global Security Initiative, to promote its brand of communism. Do you think people are becoming more aware of this, or is this kind of a stealth expansionism, ideological expansionism?
I think more and more people start to make to take notice. People have to understand communism by nature is globalism. Communism, when I grew up, we're always taught we can't achieve communism without every country in the world has achieved communism. So communism, you know, like international, it is international, it is globalism. So before, you know, the Chinese leaders say, you know, we just focus on developing our economy. We have no intention of exporting ideology. False. They were always export the Marxist ideology. And now it's become clearer and clearer to the world.
Yeah. Without giving us too much about what's going to be in your book, tell me a little bit about how you see many aspects of the Cultural Revolution now emerging in the United States. You mentioned a little bit the riots in 2020. What's your take on what's behind this effort?
I think that after people reading my book, they will realize that what's going on in America now is really Maoism. Maoism, and it's a special brand of Marxism, because Mao really get the chance to highly develop some ideologies such as political identity and cancel culture and the kind of a mass movement, and then utilize or weaponize youth. And all this, you can see that in the Cultural Revolution, that he used all these tactics to destroy, interestingly, destroy his own party, his own institutions, and why? Power. The reason he did all this is because he thought he's losing power over his party and over his government. And he wants to destroy everything, burn everything down to the ground, and build back better, and build back according to his own image, the Maoism. So that is so relevant. That's my book is about. It's about the parallels of the two cultural revolutions. Yeah. And when people read it, they will say, oh my God, yes, yes, I did not know. I thought this was just something new. No, no, no. What's going on in America is nothing new. Nothing new. It happened in all the communist countries, in most of the totalitarian countries. But to understand really what's going on, you need to understand the Chinese Cultural Revolution.
Yeah, and that's part of one of the main thrusts of my podcast is to better educate people to these. Last question: the Biden administration initially adopted some of the more realistic policies towards China from the Trump administration, but what they've done recently is one of the terrible policy flaws is that the administration gave in to a number of Chinese demands, one of which was that the U.S. would not undermine China's communist system. This is a fatal flaw in our policy. What do you think, what's the best approach the United States should take in dealing with the CCP?
Yeah, I just heard not too long ago that Pelosi was saying, you know, we're just two countries, we don't share the same value. Seriously, We don't say share the same value. No, they are the enemy of the humanity. Communism and capitalism, there's just they're not comparable and compatible. And it's not that the value is different. We have totally have different belief system. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is a time that more and more people understand that communism and our system is just, there's just no common ground. Mm-hmm. There's and people and you know, don't remember that in the 70s, and Nixon thought he would be able to cooperate with the CCP in order to bring down the Soviet Union. He did that. But then look what happened. And the CCP now become our number one enemy. You cannot cooperate with communism. You can only defeat it. We have to defeat it if we want to not just save America, not just save Western civilization, but save the world, because communism is the enemy of freedom.
Absolutely. We'll have to leave it at there. Tell us, how can people find you on social media, and how can we get the book when it comes out?
Yeah, the book can be found anywhere books are sold. Just search the title, Mao's America, A Survivor's Warning. And please follow me on X, or formerly called Twitter. I'm very active there, and I use that platform to do a lot of education and to tell Americans what communism is all about. And please follow me there. And I'm also on Facebook, but it's not very active now. There's something going on in Facebook, but you can find me with just search my name, X-I Van Fleet, V-A-N, should be a space, F-L-E-E-T. But okay. Twitter is the place, or okay. X is the place.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Victory Over Communism. Listen in again in a couple of weeks.
Thanks for listening to Victory Over Communism with award-winning national security journalist Bill Gertz, the only program in the free world unafraid to pull back the curtain of communism to reveal how the Communist Party of China and even America's own brand of Marxism pose real threats to freedom and democracy in America and the world today. See you next time on Victory Over Communism with your host, Bill Gertz.